co-host here with Jennifer Denlinger. And today we are happy to have Karen Whitico as our guest. So Karen is our CEO of our agency, and I'm just going to give you a little quick bio about Karen, and I know she doesn't love to hear all of this, but she's done some great things, and she's done some great things for our agency. So Karen has been working in the nonprofit sector for her entire career, first in treatment for 15 years and in prevention for the last 18 years. Karen received her master's in social work from Rutgers University and is a certified prevention specialist. Karen graduated from a two-year Ethical Leadership Fellowship Program in 2013 that speaks to her continual desire to provide cutting-edge services. Karen strongly believes that prevention and early intervention is the key to minimizing many societal problems. Karen has been with Prevention Resources for 18 years and has navigated the growth of the agency from a small, single county and focus agency to one with four divisions and serving four counties. Karen believes in serving the community both individually and as an agency. Prevention Resources has received many community awards, and the most recent is from the New Jersey Narcotics Association of Community Leadership. Personally, Karen has served on the board of the YMCA, Hunterdon Helpline, Education Foundation, and serves as chairman of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Karen is past president of the Rotary Club of Flemington and receives its highest awards as Rotary of the Year, a Paul Harris Fellow. Karen receives the Chamber Chairman's Award in 2008 and was Woman and Community Business Leader in 2012. Currently, Karen serves as Secretary of Flemington Rotary, Vice Chair of the Chamber Foundation, and President of the Flemington Area Food Pantry. Karen enjoys time with family and friends, the beach, of course, and her adopted fur babies who often come to the office, who are so great.
Sure. So I'm Jennifer, and I'm here with Christine. We're family support coordinators at the Family Support Center of Prevention Resources. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you today. Why don't we start, if you don't mind, with one of your favorite projects, and that's the Recovery Center in Hunterdon
yes.
County.
So for people that don't know, recovery centers are now becoming more and more well-known as the missing link for substance use disorder post-treatment. Even now, every county does not have a recovery center. So about 4 years ago, we went to our board of trustees, which is an excellent board, and we saw a gap in our community. We saw that there was no recovery center, and there was no funding available at that time. And we said, we need to do something. So on a leap of faith and hope and a prayer, the board said, let's try it. So we put some money in to opening up a recovery center, Hunterdon County Recovery Center. It's housed at 87 Park Avenue. It's open to all people in recovery. Also, it's open to people contemplating recovery. It's open Wednesday nights from 5 to 9:30 and Saturdays from 5 to 10. So the recovery center, the whole idea, recovery is defined differently by every person, but recovery, it's not just from substance use disorder. It can be from a mental health disorder. It can be from an eating disorder, anorexia, the list goes on. So there are many forms of addictions. The recovery center, by and large, is often seen as one that only treats substance use disorders, but all people that are in recovery or are struggling to be in recovery consistently for their health and well-being are welcome at the center. We have two coordinators who are going to be trained as certified peer recovery coaches, and those are people that have really lived experience so they can really relate to the people that are struggling. Addiction is an insidious disease. It's a disease that is very personal to the person. Some people can manage it quickly. Other people, it takes years. So we support people on their road to a healthy, sober lifestyle, and we also recognize that there are many paths to recovery.
One thing I love about the Recovery Center is that so many young people hang out there.
Yes.
There hasn't been, until you opened the Recovery Center, a place where they could do that and
right.
learn to have sober fun.
And that's the gap in a lot of communities. People think, first of all, we still are trying to educate people that addiction is a disease as recognized by the American Medical Association. Yet there are still people in our community that look at it as a choice, look at it as a moral failing. So there's a lot of stigma. Well, I think stigma is lessening. There is still a lot of stigma around people. So I had somebody recently say, well, if you're going to give Narcan to addicts, why don't you give insulin to diabetics? What does that tell us? There's a stigmatizing thought there. My response was we should have medicine for all chronic diseases available, regardless of one's ability to pay, whether it's insulin or Narcan.
Right.
Exactly. Because that's a way to destigmatize. So we try to educate community members. But what happens is people go into treatment. And first of all, treatment, it's difficult to access if you don't have insurance. It's the luck of the draw if there's a bed available. And if you have insurance, a lot of times it's 30 days. And most of us that have worked in this field knows that 30 days is not enough time to say somebody's done with treatment. But then what happens is, regardless if they're in a year-long program, a 30-day program, there's when they come out, they have to change most times, I'd say 99% of the time, their lifestyle.
Everything.
You can't hang out with a peer group that's continuing to use substances and think that you won't.
So you can't really just go back to your old friends
exactly.
that you used to get high with or drink with, and you can't really hang out in the same places you used to hang out
in. Right. So what does that lead people? That leads people to not having a lot of places to go and things to do. So it's interesting because there are four dimensions to recovery that are recognized as being really critical. And so I'm going to go in reverse order, though. But one is social networks, a sense of community. So if you're now sober and you want to be and you can't be with people that are still using, you may feel very isolated. You may feel very non-connected. So one of the key elements of successful recovery is a sense of community and a sense of social connection. Another one really kind of speaks to a basic need is one's health. It's health, meaning access to quality health care, taking care of medical conditions. When people are actively using, a lot of those things go to the wayside. And somebody could be actively using and have lupus or have diabetes or any number of chronic diseases and not have been managing them. Right. So really getting them to a point where they have access to good health care and can get to a healthier point in their life. Home. Housing is a very big issue.
Yes.
A lot of times people in recovery, we call it couch surfing. They can't afford to get an apartment. And if they can get an apartment, have the money, a lot of times the security deposit is a huge barrier, as well as credit.
Because in a safe area.
In a safe area. Safety is a big one.
Yeah.
So that's another factor. So we try to work with people on how can you get a roommate with somebody, or are there other places you can live that's more affordable and yet safe and not in a drug zone? We know what that means.
Because sometimes I've heard that some people come out of treatment, if they have some Medicaid, they end up in one of these Medicaid hotels, which is usually very scary.
It's very scary because most of those hotels are not there. It's not a lot of times there's a lot of drug use there.
They don't have their residents.
They don't.
They don't.
So if you are with people that are continuing to use, your risk of, we used to call it relapse, we say setbacks now, knowing that relapse is a stigmatizing term, is much higher. And the other one, the other dimension they say that's so critical to recovery is a sense of purpose. I think most of us can relate to that. We want to have a purpose in life. For some people, it's making a lot of money. For some people, it's making a difference in somebody's life. Mm-hmm. I know for those of us at this table, it's making a difference in people's lives.
Right.
And I think sometimes when people come out of recovery, maybe they were started really young. They don't have those life skills. They have to relearn that or learn them. And maybe just really never had a job. Maybe they had jobs but not a vocation. So helping them figure out what their strengths are. What do they enjoy doing? Do they enjoy art? Are they good with their hands and mechanics? So really trying to help them find a purpose. And it's not just vocational, it's also spiritual.
I was going to say, spirituality covers all of those places.
It does, it absolutely does.
So when people come to the recovery center, are they able to get resources for some of these things? Are there people they can make connections with?
Well, we work with this peer recovery coaches that they can meet with, and we always want to make sure when somebody comes in, like any forum group can get clicky, unintentionally, right? So any faith-based institution, you come into a new church, you're like,
absolutely.
Everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
If you come into a forum group. So their role is to really make sure people feel welcome, meet them at the door, how can they help them, connect them to a certified peer recovery coach. And what that means, a certified peer recovery coach has access 30 hours of training, and they have to pass a test, and then they have to be mentored and supervised to work with people, and it's to help that person on their pathway to recovery and respecting that there's many pathways to recovery. One being, we have time, we can talk about medication-assisted treatment. But so that's what we do. And then, you know, and then we also work in collaboration with the Family Success Center, Harvest Family Success Center, because their role is to strengthen and empower families, and a family can be a single person. And all their services are free of charge, so they really can sit down with the person. They don't provide counseling per se, but they can sit down with the person and help them find their direction, do employability skill training, resume writing, helping them access training, vocational training.
So they meet people where they are.
Yes.
And just to be clear, there is no cost to come to the recovery center.
There is
it's
no cost.
It's
free. It's
free. Hangout, safe.
Right. And
place
and we
to be.
And we also have support meetings there at the center, and we also have fun times. We have sober recreational activities both at the center. Sometimes we bring dinner and have family dinners, coffee night, and then every other month or so we do a sober recreational activity. It could be a flag football game. It could be attending a concert that's
important for them to
camping.
Find a new way of having fun, right?
Yes.
A new way of having fun.
Right.
So if they've identified like their interests and their purpose and this is where I want to go, is there somebody who helps them find employment or you direct them?
We're looking for funding to make our recovery center full-time.
That's actually my big question. What is your vision in a perfect world? What would our recovery center look like?
And when we say full-time, we would have some early morning hours, certainly a couple evening hours, a weekend, you know, one part of the weekend, so we could meet everybody where somebody's working 9 to 5, they can't come during the day. If somebody's working nights, they can come in the morning. Our vision, and we're looking for funding, and we'll be on top of that, is to have it open 5 days. But currently, we're open 2 days a week.
2 days, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I look forward to that day. It'll be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Something I think you said was so important was that everybody has a different path and sometimes a different length of path. And I think that's some of what we share with Sharing the Hope is sometimes we have families that come to us that are exasperated. They've been through it all.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, hold on, because sometimes number 17 at treatment is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Some others, it might be 5.
Right.
But everybody's got a different path, so there's always hope.
Right.
We share, there's always hope. You just don't know when that moment of clarity, right, when they can get it.
And that's where I think the field has changed, even from, even as I think as short a time as 5 years ago, people that were trained in the past, licensed alcohol and drug counselors, there was one way. It was abstinence. That was the only way that was recognized as being in recovery. And that has certainly changed, that they recognize there are different pathways. And for somebody that comes to, say, the peer recovery coach and says, I just can't imagine not drinking ever again. And maybe that person is drinking heavily 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So harm reduction would be, well, can we try not drinking on Monday and Thursday nights? Let's set a smaller goal. Now, some people would say, well, they're still drinking. It's called harm reduction. We're trying to lessen the impact of the harmful behavior.
I heard recently a really great way of thinking about that, that we're trying to get somebody to stop. And mm-hmm. that, as you say, can be just a really huge thing to do
yes.
and seemingly impossible. But if we can help somebody get a little less stuck,
mm-hmm.
then maybe we'll gradually be able to help them stop. But we'll have more success mm-hmm. with that ultimate goal if we can just ease them back.
And empower them while we're
less
doing
stuck.
It. Yeah.
And also empathizing and validating that if this is going to help you in your long-term recovery, then we're going to support you in that. And certainly have some monitoring to make sure that they're safe and they're healthy and they have access to care. So, and the other one is medication-assisted treatment. That's a whole other topic, but there's a lot of research that shows us that when we use medication-assisted treatment, people are much more likely to stay in recovery longer period of time.
And speaking of language, we now call that medically-assisted recovery.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's take a quick minute to listen to our sponsors, and we'll come right back.
Oh, folks, you know what that music is. That's the time for modern design.
This blue thing is a really new trend. A lot of the designers are trying to introduce blue as a new cabinet color.
This is topical for you guys. This is really topical.
And the mother said, well, I'd like her room to be gray. And the little girl said, Mom, gray is the color of depression.
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Sharing the Hope. My name is Christine Yunoso, and I'm here with my co-host, Jennifer, and we're working with Karen. We've got so many wonderful things, wonderful topics. So Family Support Partners coordinators, Jennifer and I, work with families, and we meet families with where they're at. And we are peer-to-peer. You know, we have lived experience. So we work with families who have loved ones with substance use disorders. And we can meet with a family on the phone, via text, email conversations. We'll go out for coffee. And we also have family meetings. So we have family meetings. There's two in Hunterdon County on the first and the third Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And then we have two in Somerset County, which are on the second and fourth Wednesday in Somerville. So, and that actually was down for the summer, so we just started back up. So those are always available for families who want to come out and work with each other, you know. And it's not just like a support group of put your arms around each other and cry. We want to bounce off ideas, you know, where you're at, where you've been, how we help each other, and we help really work on self-care. We work on the CRAFT model, which is based on, you know, community training and helping to empower the family.
Thanks, Christine. And also, let's put in a plug for the Recovery Center, which we were just talking about. So Wednesday and Saturday nights, 5 to 9:30 or so, mm-hmm. at 87 Park Avenue in Flemington. That's the Hunterdon Recovery
Center.
And it's
a really home-like environment. It's not a clinical office. It's not a sterile. It's a home. There's a living room, a dining room. There's different rooms. There's rooms to meet with people individually. And people love hanging out there because it feels like a warm, welcoming home.
It really does.
It really does. The first time I went there, there was a whole bunch of families eating pizza and watching some kind of TV show, some kind of movie. Mm-hmm. It must have been a movie night or something. I was like, what's happening here? Mm-hmm. It just was so welcoming. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, Karen, let's move on to the topic of interventions, because I know you're a trained interventionist. And when we think of interventions, we think of the TV show and we think of these dramatic exchanges with people. And what is an intervention like in real life?
Well, sometimes they mirror what happens on TV. They can be drama. I think a lot of it depends on the interventionist and their ability to control a situation. Mm-hmm. So when I was trained through the Johnsonian Institute and certified 10 years ago, the approach was very different. It was much more of the old tough love.
Yes.
You know, either you get sober and you get clean or we're done with you.
Yes.
And, you know, and it was a guided, the role of the interventionist is to guide and facilitate that conversation and to balance it, to balance that what they're going to say to the person with the addiction, you know, what their concern is and what their, quote, bottom line is. Sometimes that bottom line back then would seem like the best practice, mm-hmm. but that bottom line could really close the door on people. So the new approach and what we're trained in now is CRAFT, Community Reinforcement and Family Training Model, which is really more, it's designed to help people recognize their unintentional behaviors, and we used to call that enabling, very stigmatizing
yes.
term.
Yes.
What we call that now is unintentional behaviors that generally come from a position of caring and love, and, you know, inadvertently can, you know, not help the person that needs the help.
Can you say one more time the phrase you're using instead of enabling? Just caring.
Unintentional behaviors.
Unintentional.
And engaging in unintentional behaviors. And I'll give some examples of that in a bit. So, you know, so now an intervention, and I run many, is where you bring people together for three sessions. One is a practice session where you sit down with five, generally no more, because otherwise it feels like you're beating up on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Five people, and you give them some guidance on how what they want to say is, like, Jennifer, I love you. Jennifer, I care about you. I'm really concerned when I watch how heavily you drink, and I've seen you at times black out, and I think that really puts you at risk, and I care about you, and I want to help you in any way I can. What can I do to help you stop drinking?
That's very different.
That's a very different
very
approach.
Very different approach, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we're not shutting the door on them. We're not saying, get out. So we practice that using I statements, not you, because it feels like somebody's fingers in your face, whether it is or not. And then we bring the person in. And I prep the people and say, this person might walk out the door and slam the door and say, I'm done. They're not ready. Mm-hmm. And you know, the old adage, you can't force an animal to drink.
Yeah.
You can provide the water, but they have to be ready to drink that water. And in some ways, it's very similar to a person with a substance use disorder. They have to recognize that they just no longer want to live this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their decision. No one can make that decision for them. We can't drag somebody into treatment. And then, you know, depending on how that goes, sometimes the person will break down and say, I'm done. I want to get better.
Do you have treatment then ready?
We do our best. Yes, what we do is we call, right? It is hard. It depends on if they have insurance, it's less hard. If you don't have insurance, it can be very hard. Sometimes we call it the luck of the draw. Sometimes you call and there's a bed available. But if we can't get them into a residential treatment right away, we try to provide what we call wraparound services, get them a sponsor, get them connected to support groups, maybe some outpatient counseling, checking in with me as an interventionist, what can I do to help you?
So do you line up a bed ahead of time just in case, or no, they would never
It's almost impossible
bed
to
way.
Because
yeah.
they don't hold a bed
they
that way because the person that
way.
Is going to go in has to make that phone call.
Yeah.
And then we usually have a post-op. I've been working with one family now. We've tried everything.
Hmm.
The woman refused to come to the intervention, but what I'm doing is working with the family on the CRAFT model,
mm-hmm.
how you can continue to say, you know, I love you, Jennifer, but, you know, right now I'll do anything I can to help you. Really, it makes me sad to see you, you know, lose custody of your child because that is what happened. So those are the kinds of things we do. So
that actually, when you speak that way, Karen, I feel more open to you,
mm-hmm.
and I might respond to you as
right.
opposed to being belittled and shamed and scared
right.
and running. So,
and I think that's where, the field has evolved, where
yes.
we thought that was the best approach, and it was the approach that was done out of concern, but we know now that it's much more effective to be firm, loving, setting limits,
mm-hmm.
but not shutting the door on somebody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if somebody in our area wanted to have an intervention, what would they do? What would be the first step?
Well, I know if you go online, there's a lot of scams out there. There's a lot of people that call themselves interventionists and charge $5,000 and up and really have no formal training and I think are very much schooled in the old way of being. You know, there's a little bit of the drama,
right.
or a lot of drama.
Right.
That's
what they know.
Yes. So do your research. Certainly can call our agency, Prevention Resources. I'm a certified interventionist. We charge a very little amount of money, and we've often waived the fee totally for families that cannot afford to pay it. Ask questions, just like you're going to ask questions of your, you know, choosing a primary care doctor or a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to know, look at their reviews, right? Ask them what their treatment approach is. Or, you know, do they have holistic care? Are they just very linear? So ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part of that, sometimes when people get to that point when they do the intervention, that's kind of for them, they're like their last gasp.
Yes.
I've tried everything else. I've heard interventions work. So they're tired. They're beaten down.
Mm-hmm.
They're demoralized.
They're
discouraged.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're yeah. So I try to build people up and say, take a deep breath, some mindfulness. You can do this. And, you know, there's always hope. So I think when you have somebody that can take that calm approach and tell people, I know you're tired, and recognize that and validate that.
And you know what I'm hearing, Karen, is that you're reaching out. You mentioned community in the recovery center,
mm-hmm.
that's part of healing
mm-hmm.
and recovery. Reaching out to a family that's exhausted and is probably isolated in many,
mm-hmm.
many ways.
Right.
Just a connection and to feel that they're not alone, which is, you know, what we're all about, too, in meeting with family members. So I can see why that would make a difference. Can you talk to us a little more, expand on the whole idea of enabling? And because the way I look at it is it was a natural behavior
mm-hmm.
as a parent or a spouse, loving family member. But
then
everything
they were
got
bad if they did it. Right?
No, I'm going to say everything got out of balance.
Okay.
Everything got out of balance. And so caring for a person because their emotions are now more important than my own. That's what I think of as codependency, and that's what I think of those behaviors that go along with it as enabling, which have become such loaded terms.
Mm. Well, it's a stigmatizing term, and it's a term we all use, so there's no fault there. We've all used it. We've learned language matters.
Right.
So when we say things, we have to be really careful and think, how is the person that I'm directing that to going to make them feel? So I love the term unintentional behaviors,
yes.
you know, because, you know, one of the classic examples is, well, if I don't buy him the alcohol, he's going to drive drunk. And that would be considered either codependent or enabling.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we turn that around?
Mm-hmm.
There's ways we can turn that around, but, you know, rather than just saying, having the person have a heightened awareness of it and saying, you know, I love you, and I'm really concerned when you drive under the influence, I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that doesn't happen, but ultimately I can't stop you from doing that. Mm-hmm. So I think it comes from a place of love and concern for safety, especially as a parent with mm-hmm. a child. Mm-hmm. You want to do anything you can to keep them safe, or in an intimate spousal relationship.
Well, right, and I think what you describe is a false sense of security as
it
well.
It is false.
Because
mm-hmm.
We see a lot of parents who are, especially moms, I think, who are really attached to their cell phones and hanging on for that text. Mm-hmm. If they get a text, they are assured that their child is alive or, mm-hmm. you know, out of danger's way, which is also not true. We don't really know what's going on
right.
or who actually is holding on to that cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is help family members maybe take a break from their phone mm-hmm. a little bit. But, yeah, I think all of these things are done with the best of intentions, but unintentional behavior is a perfect way to describe that.
Yeah.
Because
I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say you don't realize the consequence of your action is actually opposite of what you're hoping for.
Yes.
Often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is.
I think family members, too, I've seen just working with families where they'll say, well, my husband enables him. My husband allows and I don't allow. And, you know, and it goes back and forth with that. So if we kind of get rid of that, like, mm-hmm. well, what are you doing and what aren't you doing? And, you know, how we can move on from there. And the blame game. Mm-hmm. is just not even needed, because somebody with a substance use disorder, they don't need an excuse. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a substance use disorder. It's
right.
It's not a parent's fault. You know,
it
it's
absolutely,
not
it is
a wife or husband's life.
It is a chronic disease, and we're still slow, you know, it's still very slow for people, the general lay community, to recognize that. It's a chronic disease, unlike just like every other chronic disease. And there are people that still don't believe that, and that's where the shame comes in, the stigma comes
in.
It really does,
and it is definitely recognized as a mental illness.
Absolutely.
You know, with services behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people with substance use disorders going into programs that can get emergency Medicaid. They can get services that somebody with a mental health challenge mm-hmm. can get, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that that's starting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
Yeah. Let's take a quick moment.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up to listen to our sponsors.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce. Building business, one business at a time.
Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Everybody over there,
get on up.
Everybody right there,
get into it.
Everybody right there,
get involved.
Everybody, you.
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Welcome back to Sharing the Hope. I'm Jennifer Denlinger, and I'm here with Christine Unoso, who is my cohort at the Family Support Center. And we work at Prevention Resources, where Karen Whitico is a co-CEO, and we're talking to Karen today about all kinds of things in the recovery world. So thank you, Karen, for being here. You mentioned very early on the spectrum of the world of recovery, from the recovery centers, interventions. So what are the gaps in our community?
I think, and
what do we do well? Maybe I should ask that too.
What do we do well?
Because we're doing a lot of new about things. We're doing a lot of new great things.
Oh, we are.
Peer-to-peer.
Well, you talk about the family support group. It's recognizing that we can't just look at the person with the substance use disorder, but we need to look at the impact of family. Mm-hmm. And many times those family members are overlooked in the trauma they experience by helping a loved one navigate through their substance use disorder mm-hmm. or mental health disorder. So I think having services such as the family support, which I know you've talked about, where we are providing life experience, peer-driven, helping them navigate and meet their goals of their own personal wellness,
right.
as well as helping them be educated on accessing treatment, learning about ethical versus unethical practices. A gap, as we talk about, is recovery centers in every county. Every county must have at least one recovery center.
I agree.
To be successful, and right now that does not exist. It's mm-hmm. a growing trend. You know, a lot of people like us have taken the initiative to open up a recovery center. When you don't have funding, it's hard to do that the mm-hmm. best way it can be. But you do the best you can. So, mm-hmm. you know, having a couple nights open, we are seeing 30 people on Wednesdays, 30 to 40 people on Saturdays. That says a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot of people coming that need that service and are getting something out of it. So that's one. A lot of times we overlook early intervention, and we absolutely overlook prevention. You know, prevention is avoiding high-risk behaviors, and it's helping giving people the information and education they need to make well-informed decisions about their health or a loved one's health.
Absolutely.
Yet there is virtually no money that goes into prevention, sometimes like for specific groups of people. So what we do is, and there's a statistic which is not in my head, but I think it's for every, you know, dollar you spend on prevention, you save $18 on treatment costs. If you wait until the person is in the throes of a very serious addiction that requires long-term hospitalization, detox, long-term treatment, it's much more expensive than on the upfront when we start to see early warning signs mm-hmm. and we intervene there. So there's prevention, and then there's early intervention where somebody has exhibited what we call a high-risk behavior, maybe underage drinking, use of marijuana, which is very big in our community because when the perception of harm goes down, use goes up. Mm-hmm. And the perception of harm around marijuana is very way, way down, especially with adolescents. So I think the gaps are not having recovery centers in every county. We don't have a full-time one here. The lack of understanding of prevention. It's hard to, you know, when you say you work with a family or a group of people and, you know, the light goes off because what you said to them made sense. Vaping would be a good one to talk mm-hmm. about, not in depth, but we're now starting to understand that vaping is not benign. It's not just a benign way to stop mm-hmm. helping with, you know, tobacco cessation. So I'd say prevention is a big gap, as well as recovery, but also understanding the importance of early intervention, and let's not wait until the presenting problem is so complex it's that much more expensive to treat.
Do you look at some of the early intervention with some of our adolescents with mental health challenges? Because we see a lot of that turning into self-medicating, turning into those, like, would that be considered early intervention, or that would kind of almost just be...
Well, a few years ago...
Because they really kind of coexist at a point.
Well, they do. But a few years ago, you would never say you can prevent a mental health disorder, could you? But did you ever hear that before? Do you hear it now?
No.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, meaning that you may have an anxiety disorder.
Yes.
Okay, so you have a diagnosed anxiety disorder, but you can prevent that anxiety disorder from exacerbating and controlling your life and taking over by providing an intervention and teaching a person how to manage that anxiety disorder. Coping skills, decision-making, life skills, support groups. The list is endless,
and changing
body
that
and mind, holistic
too.
Care. So that's when we say preventing. Yes, that's people believe that, and that we never looked at it that way.
Yeah.
So we waited until there was a flare up, or there was you know an incident, and then we kind of intervene there. And another one is self medication. You know, when you don't feel good, what do?
Right. Try to escape.
You take an Aleve. You take a Tylenol. For some mm-hmm. people, that's not enough because mm-hmm. what's swirling around in their head and what they're feeling, they need to just get away from that. So they take a different substance.
And they find that really.
And that's called self-medication. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it is often done because they just cannot deal with whatever it is they're experiencing. And then what happens is we develop tolerance and we
and
start
it seems
using
like a really
more.
A really vulnerable population would be the 18 to 24 crowd, because
very
that's
so.
When the mental health illnesses are really making an appearance.
And same with substance use disorders.
Yes, and the availability.
Right, and the hardest substance. Part about that group is then they're legal adults.
HIPAA.
So
and they don't have their frontal lobes developed
right,
yet.
Right, they're not. Their frontal lobes aren't developed, and they're legal adults, and they can say, "I'm done. I'm leaving home," and you can't do anything. And as a parent, you can't. You can try, but you can't do anything legally because they're not a minor. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to access that group into treatment because they're just kind of fall between the cracks. They really do.
And when they are in treatment, they get to decide who talks
talk
to who.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you're not always that social worker, that counselor, that person not really seeing the whole scope of things because it's
so
blocked.
Going back to prevention, I know as a parent what I used to think is that if I modeled responsible drinking, that you know, that was one important way. It still is important. But what I learned to tell my children was, hold off as long as you can because that brain is not done developing.
Right.
And I've worked hard to keep you healthy up to this age. So now if you can really, you know, minimize that and protect your brain for a few more years, fingers crossed, that helps. But that's a very different message than I had originally thought that I, you know, should be sharing with my kids. And I've understood it now as a brain disease, which makes it very different.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And I think helping your children, if you have a genetic addiction in your family, there's a genetic link, talking to your children at the age-appropriate time, that you are at higher risk. And we do know that if you start using a substance and drinking before the age of 15, you're five times more likely to develop an abuse or addiction issue later in life.
And my kids, in the case of my family, I have several adopted children. We don't know a medical history.
Right.
So there again, it's the same message. We don't know.
You know,
so
that's an
error. Yeah.
So
but there's good research out there that if you wait until the legal age of 21, you know, you're much less likely to develop a later onset abuse or addiction issue. And it's, you know, it's always a mix because with our agency, sometimes we'll be like, oh, you're telling everybody they can't drink. I said, no, that's not what we're saying. We're saying to model if you're a legal adult, we model responsible drinking. Who's going to drive? You know, what is responsible drinking? Do you have to have a drink every night? And, you know, do your kids see you that when you come on, the first thing you have to do is have that cocktail to decompress? There are other ways to decompress. So heightening people's awareness, but one thing you don't want to do is create this division where people think you're preaching saying you can't drink.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Alcohol has a host of issues, depending on usage, how often, you know, everything else. But it's a fine line because you want to have the education and the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're coming right back to where we started also. It's the conversation. It's making the connections. It's always being able to talk about these things without stigma and just become more informed as parents and family members. Mm-hmm. It's all right there.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
And I think hearing from others, too, for adolescents, hearing from the school counselors, hearing from people like our coalitions going in and doing programs, because sometimes moms will say something, and yeah, we know nothing when your child is 16, and because they know more, and if their brains aren't fully developed, and they're not listening to us, there's got to be somebody they're listening to, whether it's a spiritual leader, whether it's somebody going into the schools, or somebody all with the same message,
right.
You know.
Right.
Which hopefully we're going to get
consistency is key.
It's so key.
I mean, and the more people you can wrap around that situation, that
so
person.
I'll put in a plug, too, for One Voice, because their weekend of a shared topic from the pulpits is coming up next week, I believe, the 18th through 20th or so.
Yes,
and the topic is vaping. And One Voice is a coalition also under the umbrella of Prevention Resources, where clergy and law enforcement of Huntington County come together and enable conversation among families. Karen, I know you only have a couple more minutes, and I would like to ask you, I know you've had just a varied career and you've done some really amazing things in your lifetime. What have been the biggest challenges for you in your career or even now?
I think I've always, since I was 17, knew I wanted to be in a helping profession. You know, somebody challenged me to do something and I did it to help a person in need, and the endorphins went, and it was like a natural high, and I loved it, and I knew I wanted to do that. So right from college through, I knew I wanted to do that. I think my most frustrating thing is when, not just here, all over, when people don't recognize. I think some people think helping people in need is somehow giving them a way out, or you know, it's enabling or it's, there's a negativity. And I think those people who have never experienced trauma in their life, they've never experienced a child with a substance use disorder or a mental health disorder. So I think there is a lack of understanding and sometimes a lack of empathy.
Or maybe they haven't, yeah. maybe they haven't received the help that...
and that's also possible. So, but I think the big greatest challenge is us not spending more time on the upfront part of an issue or a problem, and we just wait until it's so much more expensive to treat and change and help a person.
Mm-hmm. And what have been some of your greatest satisfactions? You love the high of helping somebody and making things happen.
And I'm going back to work because I fit in a counseling appointment because she really needed to, and this was the one time she could come, so I'm going to give you this evening appointment. I think it's the little things. I don't look for, even when you read my resume, that doesn't do it for me. I think it's making a difference in a – my purpose in life is to making a difference in a person's life and to be the kindest person, and if I don't have the answers, to find the answers for somebody.
Well, Karen, I can say firsthand that you are one of the kindest people I know, and
it
is a joy to work with you and to see your smiling face
every
day.
You give to your fur babies, too.
Oh, my fur babies.
Rescue,
don't adopt, don't shop, never ever shop.
And you share your fur babies with us, so
yes,
that's awesome.
They are such an asset to our to our group. Yes.
So really, we are out of our time with Karen today, and we just want to say thank you so much
for
supporting
much.
Us and coming to talk to us
thanks,
this afternoon.
Thanks, and if you love to come back.
We are going to have you come back for sure.
Thanks, guys.
Okay,
thank
and
you.
We're here every Thursday at 5 o'clock if you want to tune in. If you like us on Facebook or leave any comments, then we would always be able to get back to you and do some, you know, if you recommend a show or topic, we're always willing to listen. So,
and also some apologies today because if you're watching Facebook Live, we have had some trouble with our video today, but it was a great interview. Hope you could stick through it and listen because Karen had a lot of really helpful
things to
say.
A lot of great things to say. Sometimes we just can't always count on those cameras. So, so
anyway.
I think that...
Pretty much wraps it up for us.
So to reach Karen or to reach us, you would contact Prevention Resources?
Yes, at 908-782-3909.
Okay, so and then there's always somebody there to pick up those phones and lead you to the right direction. So thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you for sharing the hope.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Two friends of President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, are facing charges of conspiracy and campaign finance violations.
The unseal an indictment charging Lev Parnas, Igor Fruman, and two co-defendants for their alleged participation in schemes to violate the federal campaign finance laws.
Briefing reporters in New York on Thursday, U.S. Attorney Jeff Bierman says the two men sought foreign influence and foreign political donations. Senate Democratic leader from New York, Chuck Schumer, is slamming the president's decision to remove troops from northern Syria.
President Trump's actions are putting our national security at risk in more ways than one.
Your final numbers on Wall Street for Thursday. The Dow was up 151 points to finish at 26,497. The S&P gained 19. The NASDAQ, 47. This is USA Radio News.
Filling an opening at your company means more than just finding an employee. You're looking for a fit, a match. Robert Half understands that. We know you need someone who can do the work, someone who complements your culture. And, of course, you need that someone fast. When it all comes together, it makes for a perfect fit. Satisfaction guaranteed. Robert Half, the matching experts in accounting, finance, IT, legal, marketing, and administrative staffing. Visit roberthalf.com for more information.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
The weather for this afternoon, chance of showers, cloudy with a high near 60. Winds are coming from the northeast around 19 miles an hour. I'm sorry, that was 10 miles an hour. Tonight, showers likely, mainly before 9 p.m., then cloudy with low around 48. Thursday, a slight chance of showers before 9 a.m., and then chance of rain on and off throughout the day until after 3. Then it'll be mostly cloudy with a high near 65. Thursday night, chance of rain, mostly cloudy with a low of 48. Friday, chance of rain, mainly before 9 a.m., and then mostly cloudy with a high near 62. Friday night, also a slight chance of rain before 9 p.m., then mostly cloudy. And Saturday will be partly sunny with a high near 69. And Sunday will also be mostly sunny with a high near 69. So it looks like we've got a great weekend ahead, and I'm just really glad we finally got rain. And it is currently 56.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial Advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center.